This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. You can subscribe to the app on Apple and Android. Visit FUBARradio.com for more details.
James Acaster on FUBAR Radio.
Welcome to FUBAR Radio. My name is James Acaster. My guest today is performance poet Luke Wright, and we're going to be putting our iPods on shuffle. Pavement on FUBAR Radio with Major Leagues. Open us up. Welcome. That goes on for ages. Just letting that carry on. Pavement don't really know how to finish songs. I don't know if anyone's aware of that. But they tend to just let it go on for a while until they all go, oh, that's the end of the song then. Run out of ideas. My guest today is Luke Wright. Hello, Luke.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Yeah. Nice to be here on this Sunday afternoon.
You are the most composed of our guests so far. Normally people are sitting there quite nervous about what their iPod's about to throw up. And you seem quite confident.
Well, you might feel that I should be ashamed of some of the things that are going to come up, but I don't feel ashamed, so we'll have to see. There's quite a lot of stuff on there, so
I encourage that attitude.
Yeah.
Well, I'm always concerned about how worried people are. I think, come on.
I think some of the things I'll hate, really? And cringe at the most will be the stuff that people regard as being like quite, you know, they're the albums that I bought because they've won some major award and I've listened to them twice and hated them.
So it'll still look
like,
cool.
Yeah, like if the XX come up, I'll feel physically ill.
But I've never
like,
listened to them.
What are they? I guess I must have because I bought the album. I'm not sure I even got through it. I didn't like it.
Yeah.
That's sort of petulant thing. I'm just like, I don't like it. And then I sort of revert back to type, which is kind of, you know.
I'm not too keen on the name either.
The XX.
It's a bit pompous, isn't it?
It's one of the bands as well, and it came right at the end of the band sort of kind of craze. I remember that being like the height of coolness. I was in a band when I was, must be like 17, so like right at the end of last century.
Yeah.
We called ourselves the Hundreds. We never did any gigs, but we thought that was a really cool name. It felt really classy having the. And then it became the thing, didn't it?
Yeah.
The.
Well, it goes in waves. There'll always be an era when it's always the.
Yeah.
And then they will stop, and it's really cool to just go straight in with Hundreds.
Yeah.
And suddenly that's a good band name.
That's,
and then it comes back, though. The comes back around
still,
again.
It's still good, isn't it? Hundreds. I think the Hundreds.
I think the Hundreds is good, to be good honest. How many of you in the band?
There was just me and my mate Hugh. And
great.
It was good. We could have made it.
What kind of music?
It was just sort of ramshackled. What I'd like to think was sort of. They call it lip pop, don't they? That kind of the Bell and Sebastian end of things. It wasn't as complicated as that, but I thought my lyrics were quite obviously very intelligent and on it. It was just kind of, it was indie music.
So
really.
We were thrash.
We were into Blur. We were into Blur and Libraries. So you can imagine.
It wasn't at 17, mate. Everyone was hanging out down the library.
Yeah. Apart from the kids who wanted to beat us up.
Yeah, who were waiting out. Well, they were hanging out outside the library.
They were also at the library, weren't they?
They knew exactly where to go. They knew what to use as bait to kill a mockingbird under a cardboard box. But writing lyrics then.
I was, yeah.
Were you thinking maybe this is the direction I want to go in? Because obviously, for those of you who don't know, you do poetry now.
Yeah, I'm a poet, yeah. And that's my actual job. So I was sort of 14, 15 and discovered music and I thought the lyrics like really spoke to me and started writing lyrics. Well, I started writing songs, but I couldn't play an instrument.
Mm.
And I taught myself to play an instrument and the lyrics became sort of rudimentary songs and I managed to coerce some other people into a band and we did that for a while. And then I was 17 and I saw a... went to Colchester Arts Centre and I saw John Cooper Clarke a guy called Martin Newell do pop poetry, you know, stamp poetry and tell gags in between. And it was just this wonderful fusion of everything I loved because I loved comedy as well. I kind of got into comedy via Python, obviously, and Blackadder, but also Fist of Fun. That was like my favourite thing on when I was a kid. And so this was the mix of comedy, lyric writing and that sort of that rock and roll kind of swagger with the cleverness. It was all sort of there and I was a month before I was up on stage doing my own terrible poems.
That quick?
Yeah, calling myself a big poet.
You can do whatever you like. You can incorporate everything into poetry.
It's a really broad church because you, and what's interesting is that I meet or have met a lot of people doing spoken word performance poetry, whatever it's called this week, and they've gone off to do different things. So they're playwrights or they're rappers or they're songwriters or they're stand-up comedians, and they're either retreating from those other genres or they're about to go out into them.
Right,
it's anything goes really. So you can go along and do a monologue. do a bit of acting. You can do a rap. You can kind of sing, and people are kind of very accepting of it. It's a lot easier than the comedy crowds as well. So you get a lot of bad comedians who perhaps can't quite make it on the circuit yet, trying out stuff there.
I did a poetry night as a. They're advertised as an open mic competition in the middle of the night. I didn't know it was a poetry night.
Mm-hmm.
So I went as a stand-up and just did stand-up when everyone else was doing poems.
With the lyrical quality, everyone's, you know. A lot of poems are, you know, I mean, a lot of people who do spoken word pieces, they're not, you know, they're not poetic in any way. There's no sort of sonics, there's no rhyme, there's no meter. It's just, you know, it's a short... musing upon something, and often those are comedy. It's someone like Rob Orton, who we were mentioning just before we went on air. You know, he's a poet and actually writes some really quite beautiful little poems as well. But his live act is all about sort of, you know, non sequiturs and one liners, and that's when the boundaries become really, really sort of blurred. So.
Yeah, for people who haven't seen Rob, he does shows that are often themed around one quite broad and simple subject. Like, he did the Face show last year.
And the Sky show and the Yellow show.
He's working on the Water show last time I saw him.
He is.
If you want to
check
see a
that
show
one out, kids.
All about water, you should go and see Rob
Orton. It's a surefire hit in the making.
It's the man to do it. Also, as you said about the rap stuff now that posted. Is that, how recent is that?
The rapping that the children are doing.
The rapping that the kids are doing. Because with performance, see, the first that someone like me, who's sort of very much on the outside of all of this, ever like got familiar with a performance poet doing rap would have been Scroobius Pip, maybe Saul Williams before him.
Yep.
Has it been going on for ages and ages, or is it as recent as I think it is?
I certainly remember there being... I mean, hip hop, I think, got really mainstream popular probably at the end, in the 90s, probably, you know, in that mainstream. I remember, like, people kind of, before that, it was a bit more niche. And it definitely, I think, drove people towards spoken word because there was a chance for the rappers, he maybe couldn't cut it without a beat. Or the other way, had more to say and didn't want the beats drowning them out.
Yeah.
And they sort of came to spoken word. So there's always been that crossover. For as long as I've been doing it for 16 years, there's always been that crossover that I can remember. But there's more of it now, I think. And people like Pip and Kate Tempest and I guess now George the Poet are kind of legitimising that. You know, it's seen as a normal thing to do, to be, you know, recording other beats in one place and then doing stuff a cappella the next. But, you know, that's not a new thing. That's been around for as long as hip-hop has, really.
Yeah. Oh, brilliant. Well, I mean, Kate Tempest might even... I did a gig with Kate Tempest at the Ivy, of all places.
Did you? Really?
Yeah.
That's keeping it real.
Yeah, but she's really down to work. she did a poem that was like, she felt like she really needed to do it there about like poor people in England and stuff like that, and the rich people in the Ivy really doing their best to understand.
No one ever thinks of that person. I watched The Casual Vacancy recently. I don't know if you saw it, the adaptation of J.K. Rowling's novel, which I couldn't get through as prose. Mm-hmm. I thought it was turgid, but good story, and I like the BBC adaptation of it. Anyway, I read a review of it in The Telegraph, which is not a newspaper I take, but this guy was, the reviewer was saying, oh, well, you know, it was great and it was heartbreaking. You know, and Casual Vacancy is a satire, right? It's a left-wing satire, basically. And he expresses sympathy with a character that he refers to as a chav with a heart.
So
no one knows that they're the people being satirised. Everyone always thinks, look at those terrible people. Whilst noshing into their food, they're not Ivy.
So. Like a modern-day Wizard of Oz.
Indeed.
Chav with a heart,
eh? Because they don't normally have hearts.
Yeah, normally. They're just keying cars eating fried chicken. They wouldn't know what they're doing. Right, let's move on to iPods on Shuffle. I've got my iPod on Shuffle. I always take the first plunge.
Hit,
I think that's fair enough. So we'll see what mine throws up, and then we'll move on from there. Here we go. I'm worried that this is the whole song, just warning you right now. 3 minutes left of this. I really just downloaded this for my sister's wedding for her to walk down the aisle to. That's the only reason I've got it on my iPod. The worst thing is I've got a feeling this song goes somewhere at some point, but I have no idea when. It's a band called Hella, by the way. If you're interested in getting more of their stuff, they've got an extensive back catalogue. That's Hella. Hella there. Hella there with 2012 and countless. Great stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, no one's disputing that. Amanda's certainly not shaking her head in the producer's booth. Great fun. I actually really enjoyed that when it kicked in.
It was good.
I'd forgotten that I liked that album. I've got that because I love the drummer. It's one of my favourite drummers. I don't know if you've ever bought everything that anyone's ever done.
No, I haven't done that. I don't think so. I don't know. Is that true? I guess there's some people you'll always buy their stuff, even though you know you went off their stuff years ago. Like, I'll always buy anything that Griff Rhys does.
Yes.
Yeah. And to be honest, the last couple of Civ Very Animals albums didn't really do it for me. And his solo stuff, oh yeah, I quite like it.
Yeah.
I don't like it enough to buy it, and yet I always buy it because you know, I will support that man until one of us dies.
I stuck around longer than I wanted to at the Green Man Festival one year because they were closing, and I was miserable. I'd been to the Edinburgh Festival beforehand for 2 weeks, and I'd camped, and my tent had got flooded on the first night.
Edinburgh.
Yeah, it was horrible.
Wow,
I didn't have any money, so
Whereabouts did you camp? Is that one down sort of down by the?
No, it was one that was like 20 minutes by bus outside of the festival. So I was having to get the bus every day, and the campsite was in a caravan club site, but it was like in a bowl shaped field. So
it's good for a campsite.
And it was raining for 2 weeks solid, so my stuff got flooded on day one.
Was that 2009 by any chance?
2008.
The
other year where it rained for the whole
those years quite well,
horrible. And then straight to Green Man, where it was a festival in Wales, so it's raining even more in the same tent.
I went to Green Man once and it rained all weekend. It was a pretty sad experience.
Performing there or?
Yeah, I was doing a gig there. I don't think I would have made the trek otherwise. But I mean, I said that, you know, I get to perform at a lot of festivals, so I guess festivals lose their shine after a while. I mean, I love them, and I wouldn't do it otherwise, because no one does festivals to make money.
Yeah.
But yeah, I probably wouldn't go to a festival if I wasn't performing these days, because you know, I get my fill of sleeping in a tent.
Yeah, I find how grumpy I am at festivals now is the 15-year-old me would be astonished.
Yeah, mortified at our attitude towards the things we get to do. But you know, there's only so much tent you can take.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. Maybe a couple of years ago at Latitude, I went for the whole thing, and was performing on the first day maybe, and then just stood around. I felt like I'd locked myself out of my house. So like, what was I putting myself through this for? And then I think I saw like one band I liked the whole weekend, and that was it. And I was just very moody.
Mm.
And that was, and Green Man was the worst. Green Man, because it was raining so much, I went to the tea and cake tent, where you can only stay there if you bought some cake. A cup of tea, indeed. I think I bought both and then just passed out in a deck chair in there. And then woke up halfway through, some guy from Fairport Convention was playing. And a lady was dancing near me. She had ribbons tied to her wrists and stuff and dancing. And she said, "Did you enjoy your sleep?" And I said, "It was better than staying awake and being confronted with the reality that's surrounding me right now." That's what I said to someone.
Woo! Everyone likes you at a party.
Everyone hated me in that tent. Everyone in that tea and cake tent rightfully looked at me like I was an absolute dick.
Yeah, well, it was muddy and it was cold.
It was muddy and cold, wasn't it?
Who can blame you?
Yeah. But any festivals lined up this year?
Yeah. Well, I program all the poetry at Latitude, so I'm doing that.
Great.
And I'm doing Glastonbury, and I'm doing Festival Number 6 to program the line up there. I'm doing something there. That's a nice one. Rain.
Festival Number 6. I went there last one.
That was glorious.
Brilliant.
The first 2 years were pretty wet though, but it was glorious this year. Really nice. So I'm looking forward to that. And then
and it looks like the set of a Wes Anderson film. That's what my friend Nish pointed out. It feels like you're walking through a Wes Anderson film.
It is a bit like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All the colours.
It's a pretty place. I'm doing Port Elliot as well, which I always love doing.
Lovely.
I love that.
I went there, and it was the year that Dominic West was.
Yeah, we met him. He was. He was letting his kids roll down a massive hill, and my mate Nathan who's lovely, but he's a bit of an idiot and likes to sort of like create awkward situations for everyone. Yeah. Ran up to him and said, "I loved you in the West Wing."
God,
which was just terrible, isn't it? It's like not even funny anyway, and he just looked a bit weirded out, and we had to, you know, it was just awkward. But he seemed like a very nice chap.
Lovely. Me and Joel Dommett intercepted a photo. He just finished having his photo taken with someone, and as that person and their friend taking the photo went away, we just went in their places, took another one, and he just started laughing, and my friend Joel started laughing. So it's a lovely photo of both of them looking like their best mates. They just look like they really get on. Yeah. But yeah, poor Elliot. I really liked that.
Magic down there.
Saw Evan Dando playing, and they kept on being power cuts, and he just ignored it. And carried on playing for it, so it was quite.
Apparently,
nice.
When Oasis first started out, like they were doing their Definitely Maybe tour, Evan Dando just decided they were the greatest thing ever, and right. he was having a bit of a break from the Lemonheads, and just attached himself to the Oasis tour. Okay. And they thought, great, cool, Evan Dando's on tour with us, yeah. And you know he was good fun. And then one night they came back from the gig, and he was on the roof of the hotel playing impromptu gigs to people, and that was the moment that they realised that Evan Dando had to go. That he had out-partied Oasis.
Yeah,
and just made a colossal pain in the arse of himself.
Yeah, it's in his own world. I found we shared a backstage room, so the comedy was on before the headliner each day. Weirdly.
Yeah, and in that tent at the bottom of the hill. We should tell people who don't know what Port Elliot is. It was a literary festival initially, which has kind of branched out to be more general arts festival.
Yes.
And it happens near a place called Saltash, just over the border into Cornwall. Yeah. And it has that kind of weird, that's not fair, is it? But sort of eccentric Cornish kind of vibe to it. It's a little bit Wicker Man down there, but in a good way. It's a lovely place.
A lovely Wicker Man.
Wicker Man.
With portobello and halloumi burgers,
food. That's the difference with festivals. The food has got better at festivals. When I started going to festivals in the 90s, it was Greasy Burger Man all the way. And now it is all kind of gourmet extravaganza.
You just need one person to up their game, and everyone shits themselves.
Because
that's just so good.
And everyone goes there.
Everyone's going there.
I went to this festival in Wales called Dynevor. I think it's pronounced like that. It's a literary festival in Wales, and they're trying to be the Welsh Port Elliot. And I went the first year, and it's always interesting going to a festival the first year because they haven't got quite a lot of things right yet. So either people get trapped on site, or like, you know, or things flood, or portaloos, you know, collapse. But they just hadn't got the food right. There was like one burger van. I thought this is not going to work. It's because it's all about, you realise that you've been spoilt into having a gourmet extravaganza.
Absolutely.
In the field, that's what it's about for me.
I mean, the crepes at festivals now are out of this world.
I go for the crepes. I don't really watch anything at festivals. I tend to just sort of drink and eat, basically.
I don't think there's a single actual like permanent crepery in the world as good as a crepe van at a festival.
Things taste better in fields, don't they?
Yeah. What favourite crepe filling? If I was to get you one right now, I'm not lulling it out, Luke. What would you have in it? You're a savoury or sweet guy?
That's what I'm trying to decide between. I think right now I've got a hankering for something sweet, so I'd probably go Nutella and banana. That'd be good. It's not out there, but you know, it's solid, dependable.
Good safe.
But at the same time, I'm very happy going with the ham and cheese option. Nice bit of cheese, nice bit of ham. You know, I like a savoury crepe. I'm more of a savoury guy than a sweet guy.
But the last thing you ate was savoury, I'm guessing. I'm not trying to Devon Brown you.
It was the last thing. I had a bit of a fry up.
Yeah.
Yeah, with the kids back in Suffolk before I drove down here. Though I do think that when we get onto the subject of are you a sweet or savoury man, we're probably running out of conversation. Maybe
you might think that. It would usually be my first port of call. It's usually, I mean, for me, that opens up so many avenues you have no idea. I love sweet and savoury chat. With crepes, I tend to go too overboard. So you've gone for two fillings in each one.
I've just gone for very, very, oh right, you mean...
I get like the whole deli.
The whole deli in it.
I just have everything in there.
And you sound like you're more of a seasoned crepe eater than I am. I'm not opposed to a crepe. I just guess I'd always go for a bowl of really, really hot and spicy noodles.
Yeah.
Given the choice, yeah. That's my go-to festival snack.
Straight to the noodle place. That's absolutely fair enough, mate. Absolutely fair enough. No one's going to make fun of you for that. Speaking of festivals, here's Luke's iPod.
Great, Luke.
Feeling good?
Seamless. I just hope it's not going to be boring.
I don't think it'll be boring.
Oh, yeah? Well, you can see what it is, can't you?
Let me have a little look. Oh, I can see what it is. Here we go. Well, make up your own mind.
Do it.
Whether it's bored or not. Here we go. Young Jobless. The Cleaners from Venus with Young Jobless from Luke Wright's iPod. Luke is a poet, and that band's name rhymes.
The Cleaners from Venus. It's either... I used, I used to think that when I first heard it, I thought, oh my God, what an awful, awful name. That's just such a terrible name. Like, no wonder they never made it.
Right.
But over the years, it's really sort of grown on me. And often people just call them the Cleaners, which is quite cool.
Right.
So yes, it's a guy called Martin Yule, who's he's a probably better known as a poet these days, or it was for a while anyway, and the music's kind of taken off again, and he's in his 60s now, but he was that's a track from 1980, but that sounds fresh, like, and he was making jangly English pop music, but was always just sort of out of time with what was going on. Like, really, you know, if he'd been a few years older, Britpop probably would have adopted him and he could have had some success. But by the time the 90s came knocking around, he was a belligerent, difficult man in his 40s. He refused to go to London for anything. So he's the guy who got me started in poetry. You know, I saw him perform poetry before I saw anyone else perform poetry. And his music's great. I love it.
You must be pretty glad that threw that up.
Yeah, that makes
sense. I mean, some people listening to that might think that wasn't on shuffle and you chose that, but you didn't.
I was almost perfect, I think. Yeah. I was like a sort of a... it's like Desert Island Discs sort of choice that.
Yeah, landed on your feet completely there. You brought some poems in as well.
I see you're
flipping for it. Now, what you've got in front of you looks like more a notebook that you'd be... That's for gigs and stuff like that?
I don't tend to read on stage. I memorise everything pretty much. But when I've got a new piece, I'll put it into the notebook. And if it's a friendly gig and I feel... Yeah, and I need like a cue, and I'll read it. Generally, I don't until I know it off by heart, but I find the best way of learning a poem is to sort of mostly know it and take it on stage with a bit of paper and do it in front of an audience. And there's something about the process of reading it in front of people sort of seals it in your head.
But, is that, I mean, in general, I mean, I guess I haven't seen many performance poems, but the ones I have seen, they're off book. There's not, but does some kind of like have.
Yeah, well, again, it's that sort of what my mate Joe Dunthorne always says, that when he watches a poet walk on stage without a book, he thinks they're going to be shit, because he's a snob. Because that tends to be the more slammy sort of style of, you know, whereas the more sort of pagier, considered more literary poets tend to sort of read, because that's not really their job. I personally think you're able to make a much better connection with an audience if you perform off paper.
Yeah.
But there's all these sort of theories around it. You know, some poets, and I've heard Simon Armitage say this before, he says he'll always try and read his poems in the most deadpan way possible, because otherwise the poet inserts himself in between the poem and the audience.
The poem
should exist as the writer on the page. However, Simon Armitage can't escape that, because the moment he walks on stage and does his anti kind of performance thing, which is kind of, oh, Simon Armitage, you know, oh, you know, I'm just so, you know, I'm not showbiz, because it's actually all an act, and actually he looks like he's reading his poems, but he knows them off by heart. He's going to hold the book there, and I don't mean that to be horrible to Simon Armitage, who I think is awesome, but you know, I think that's slightly disingenuous, because it's always an act when you get on stage.
Yes,
it's always an act. Different people do different things. So some people try and make shambolic and do like an anti kind of act. I'm the opposite. I am kind of all out, you know, like, you know, thrusting, running around the stage, you know, holding the mic. And I think that's just the way it feels right to me.
It must help get across what you mean as well. Because, I mean, just saying it deadpan, surely in some ways leaves a lot of responsibility on the audience.
It depends how the audience is going to listen to the poem. I think I do a gig, like, I think not too dissimilarly from the way you do a gig, from where stand up would do a gig, where it's, there's an audience in front of me and I'm going to communicate some stuff to them. There's a kind of honesty in poetry. Where's the sort of the unspoken truth with comedy is, like, you're here to laugh, I'm here to make you laugh. If we make too much of that, then the magic will die. So there's a suspension of disbelief, where there's, I mean, a bit more honest about the poetry, in so much as like, hello, I'm going to read you some poems now, here is the poem, you know. And I guess some people feel that it's even more honest to have the book in front of them, and so people can see that they're reading it out. But I just think, you know, for the way I do it, makes, and also I'm dyslexic, so I'm not the best. I'm not incredibly dyslexic, but I am a bit dyslexic, and therefore not a great reader of stuff off the page.
Yeah.
I tend to sort of, you know, let my eyes falls on the line below, and I'll misread lines. So it's much better. I found really early on it was much better just to learn it off by heart.
Yeah.
And you feel more confident as well, and you're able to sort of do the work of the gig, because it is work. You know what it's like when you're gigging. You're constantly thinking about the next thing. You're thinking, well, should I do this bit? How am I going to do that? How should I play it? Maybe should I move to this part of the stage? You know, you're constantly working as you're speaking, and you're not able to do that if you're reading something off the page.
And did that evolve? Did you start out straight away knowing that you wanted to do that, or over the years did you go, actually,
I don't think I had a clue what I was doing when I started, and I think I just wanted to get on stage and sort of shout the poems. And, you know, John Cooper Clarke was an early role model, And so, you know, it was the idea of doing the poems as fast as possible, like they were punk songs. It'd be, you know, you just rant the poems out. I definitely saw myself as a ranter, and that being a good thing. And you know, that there's a little bit of that left in me. You know, I definitely still have the odd rant poem here and there. You know, that can be good. I mean, that sort of, people love that splenetic kind of controlled anger. You know, load of comedians, you know, going rants and stuff like that. It can be a beautiful thing if there's not too much of it. So I definitely have that sort of part left in me, but I try and be a bit more controlled. And I like to tell stories, and I like to sort of, you know, and I do sad and I do funny, and I do sad and I do funny. It's definitely much more of a mix of that now, much less sort of play for laughs than when I started out, just simply because there were things I wanted to do. And I kind of felt, well, if I'm just going to make people laugh, then I'd be better off from a career point of view just trying to do stand-up, trying to take these ideas. But what I really love, and that stand-up could give me to a certain extent, but not in the same way, is I love the sound of poetry. And of course there's a musicality to stand-up as well, and there's some stand-ups are incredibly what's his name, Will Hodgson, for example, really sonorous, and there's, you know, it's almost like spoken word, it's like poetry. But there's something about writing in meter and using rhyme and those things that I really, really love, and comedy can't give me that. And also, now that I'm in the genre, I can get away with large chunks of the show, which is just storytelling, sad storytelling, you know, and that's fine, and there's no pressure. And I like that lack of pressure. And every time I find myself in front of a comedy audience, if I keep my nerve, it's fine, because actually they just want to listen. Yeah. The moment, but you do tend to start thinking, oh, I've got to make them laugh, And some audiences as well will not accept, you know, 2 minutes without a laugh. You know? So I started to find it really kind of unsatisfying doing comedy gigs. I very rarely do like a comedy club now.
Have you ever been to a storyteller's night when it's like not a comedy night, but like they tell stories?
Yeah, I have. And we've done some of that. I run a little night in London called Homework with Ross Sutherland and Joe Dunthorne and Tim Clare and John Osborne and Molly Naylor and Katie Bonner. It's a big group of us. And the idea is we have homework every month. We have to go and write a new thing on a theme and bring it along. And that can take any form, whether it be stand-up or poetry or, you know, showing a short film or doing an interview with someone. And sometimes, you know, we started doing inspired by The Moth, we started doing True Story Nights. And, you know, once a year we do that. And I've been to a few other places. I've been to Sarah Benetto's Storytellers Club, and I've told stories, and I've also done poems there, which are not, you know, which are stories but in verse. And yeah, they're nice. It's a nice vibe, it reminds me of when I do my own gigs.
Yeah,
because, you know, primarily I do my own gigs. I mean, they're either tour gigs or people have come along to see me, and they're always the best ones, because there's much less pressure on you there in a way, because you know people are invested enough to come out and spend a tenner or whatever it is to come and watch you, and so I can relax into those. And the other thing I do quite a lot of is support John Cooper Clarke on tour, and so it's nice in some ways, because you know it's going to be a nice massive full venue, which which is not up to you to fill, but I guess there's a bit more pressure. I do tend to sort of lean towards the more sort of lighter cabaret end of things.
Yeah. Do you find yourself, I mean, looking back at when you first saw him and you decided you wanted to do poetry, and just thinking, how did this happen? Or?
Yeah, well, weirdly, I'd met him before I saw him do poetry, because he lives in Colchester, and I just sort of randomly had a drink with him once, and some other people were all in this pub, and I didn't even know who he was, apart from being a very, very cool guy, because he was just the coolest guy in the pub, and he's totally, you know, he's a great conversationalist, and everyone just hung off his every word. So I knew he was great, but he's a very approachable, very generous person, and like I've known him for such a long time now. And I was really ballsy when I was 17. I'd done like one gig. I somehow got his phone number, and I'd ring him up and say, "Can you come to this gig in Norwich for me and my mates? I haven't got any money to pay you, but it'd be fun." Yeah. And he, you know, a couple of times he did. You know,
right?
I mean, he wasn't back then the name that he is now, because he was kind of going through it. A lot of people thought he was dead for years. I thought John Cooper died.
Perfect time to meet him.
It's funny, isn't it? Because for 20 years, you know, he just sort of plugged away, playing 150 people. You know. Yeah. Sporadically, and then all of a sudden everyone was like, "Oh my god, John Cooper's the coolest thing ever," it goes around, and
yeah, all of a the right people becomes, remember you, and then talk about you again, and suddenly everyone falls.
And it's funny doing those gigs now, because half the people I think are genuinely into poetry and genuinely into spoken word, and I think half the people it's kind of almost a nostalgia trip for them. You know, they want like, "I saw John, I saw you at the Borderline, and you know, 1979 and you know, so you know, they're those gigs can go either way, because sometimes they are just there to see John because he's John, not necessarily because of what John's doing or how John's going to do it. And so having another poet on the bill, you'd be better off having another punk on the bill. You know?
Right, yeah.
So you really have to sort of kind of win them over. But it keeps your match fit, you know, doing those 20, 25 minutes again. Because I'm used to doing 90-minute sets now.
And doing support for people who don't want to see you, essentially, is really good training.
It's great training. It's not ideal.
I just say you'd rather do tours on your own when they want to come see you.
I think it's a mix of both. I think it's great to do that, because also you're playing venues that you can't do on your own, which is why you're the support artist. So, you know, we play the Royal Festival Hall in October. That, incidentally, is too big, I think, for spoken word. but it was a great experience to do it, a great experience to be in those venues, you know. But generally I love those sort of 800-seater old theatres, like old Victorian theatres, like the Tyne Theatre in Newcastle. Just, they're beautiful buildings, and, you know, I might never walk into those places again, you know,
unless
I'm going to buy a ticket and sit in the stalls. So, yeah, I savour every moment of those gigs.
Yeah, when I did support for a comedian called Milton Jones, and it was like those kind of venues that I thought, this could be the only time I ever perform better appreciate it now.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, let's move on to another song. After that, though, I'd love to hear one of your poems, if that's okay.
Yeah, let's do that.
Is that all right? Also, if anyone wants to call in or email in or tweet in, call in on 0330223 0200. Can you tell I've never read that out loud before? James@foobarradio.com and tweet @foobarradio. Back to my iPod. Let's see if it embarrasses me again. Yeah. Easy Money by Barbara Luck. Absolutely happy with that, personally. Don't care what anyone thinks.
Nice.
I love him. He is. He was in a band called King Prawn, a ska band, years and years ago. And he was a bassist in that. And now he just does his own solo stuff. And yeah, I think I was telling you off air when I first saw him in Kettering. Well, for one, it was at a lock-in in a pub, and I got there. I'd bought a ticket, but I got there after I'd locked the door, so I had to jump the wall and get in round the back, and then get accosted by the landlord and talk my way in by showing him my ticket, and then watch Barbara Luck play it by himself to us, and then talk to him afterwards and realise that the man was he's a great guy to talk to, but he's all over the shop. He'll just tell you how we should have peace and love in the world, but also women should carry knives and stab people who give them any shit. So, you know, good guy. But I like that. I like
an old-fashioned sort of a gent.
Yeah. But I like the flawed. I don't really like performers or artists who seem like they got it together.
Yeah, you want them to be sort of, you know, authentic sort of wretches, you know.
Yeah. I think that's a very good way of putting it. Yeah.
People want that. People do like that in a performer. They like to think that they live and breathe it, that they totally mean it. I think that's one of the reasons people like Kate Tempest so much, is that, you know, is that sort of authenticness, or sense of authenticity anyway, yeah.
Well, she was
authenticity. Authenticness, that's not a word.
She said she used to get up on tube trains and stuff and just start doing poetry to people, is that right?
Did you? I think any poet has got up on a tube train and started doing poetry to people if they've taken enough drugs or... I know I have. I don't know how regularly she did it, but that's a nice story, isn't it? Yeah.
Can you remember how it went when you did it?
Well, I used to in the sort of last days of college, I used to go out clubbing quite a lot, and talking quite a lot at strangers, and inevitably they say, "What do you do?" And I go, "I'm not a student, I'm a poet." And they go, "Do us a poem." You go, "Okay, I'll do your poem." Everyone's going, "Yeah, man, yeah." It's grim clubby stuff. Yeah. So yeah, I've definitely done loads of random poems, and I've been at the Stone Circle at Glastonbury, and everyone's like taking a megaphone and taking it in turns, and I've done that. I remember once, actually, when I must have been about 16, grabbing the megaphone, and there was a big circle of people at the Stone Circle at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I just ran out this poem that I'd written, and people loved it. Do you know what I mean? Because most people have just been shouting like inanities about peace and love or whatever, and then doing something that's felt like substantial, I guess. Lots of words. There's a lot of it, I think, people... The poems, I think, have a wow factor. If there's just a lot of words and they sound like they all belong together, or they rhyme, or they scan, or they've got a nice sort of flow, people like hearing that. Yeah. If you think about, like, a lot of hip-hop and a lot of rap and stuff, like, do people really follow the words first time? No, I don't think so, because it's coming so fast, isn't it, over beats. Yeah. Actually, people just like the sound of it. There's something really sort of pleasing. There's a real sort of wow factor to hearing rhythmical, sonorous words. And I think, you know... people can like that, and it's a real kick to be able to deliver those to people in that sort of very raw yeah. sort of kind of guttural way.
I think Eminem only gets the complaints the second time that people listen to his songs. That's the first time they're like, pretty good rhythm. Like, next time out, this is homophobic.
Yeah, exactly. People, I've hear poets get away with saying the most atrocious things, I think, because people aren't really listening, which I don't know how it makes me feel. Some people can get really cross about that and think the people aren't listening to every word, but you know, they're maybe not so fussed about the musical quality of it. I think that's a really important part for me, that things sound good.
But I find that's that thing as a performer where, like, what I expect of the audience and what I actually deliver when I'm an audience member are two very different things. Like, they're not listening, they're looking like they're not even enjoying it, and then I sit in an audience and I'm just stony-faced while inside having the time of my life.
Exactly right. People's listening faces are haunt me. I remember once doing a gig in Taunton, and this bloke, he was like three rows back and he was on the edge and he sat there, like, arms folded, stony faced all the way through. He didn't even clap at the end of poems, and not that I think I deserve to be clapped, but like, that's just audience etiquette. That's the way that the energy is released, and it's the way it works, really. And I just, you know, I began to really resent him. You know, there's 30, 40 people enjoying it. About 30 people. I mean, that gig was quite small, and then you've got this one guy and he's not enjoying it, and I'm focusing on him. And then after the gig, he's the first guy to come bounding up to me, like, buys like three CDs for his mates and stuff. And was like so enthusiastic and loved it. And you know, ever since him, I've always tried to sort of assume that everyone just thinks I'm great, but they just got weird faces. It's
a very good way of doing things.
Well, you've got to, because you can't give your best, can you? If you think everyone hates you, then you're going to start putting those vibes out.
I ruined a gig in Glasgow, which had gone perfectly well. But then the only way I could walk off was through the audience. And so as I did, there was one person just folded arms, not clapping me off stage. And so I nudged him on the way past, went, "Clap, mate." And he just looked at me and went, "No." Because he said no, I just stopped. And I basically was like, trying to make a joke out of making him clap.
Yeah.
But he just wouldn't go along with the joke out of it. So he just kept on making it more and more serious and personal until it got to be a proper thing of me just going, "Oh, well... that's it then. That's it. This is me telling a man to clap, him refusing to." And everyone going, "Oh, so not all of us enjoyed that." And then I had to just go back to the hotel going, "They wouldn't have known if I kept my mouth shut." No one would have known about that guy at all.
It's a funny thing, though. But you must have sat in an audience and watched somebody be not funny on stage or be not funny in your opinion. And you do start to have this real sort of kind of loathing for them. Because what we don't like is people, we don't like pretension. We don't like people saying that they're one thing and not living up to it. So, you know, even though I know it takes a huge amount of courage to walk on stage and everyone has good days and bad days, I know they're better than anyone else. I've been gigging for 16 years. Is, you know, and yet I can watch someone just go, "All right, mate, yeah, come on, clear off." I'd be so judgmental. And I think as we don't like people puffing themselves up, which of course you've got to do if you're about to get on stage.
You've got to do it to some degree. You get it just a fraction wrong.
Yeah.
And you've gone too big or you've gone too small. And it's just not
exactly.
It just doesn't work.
But I do always have more respect for the people who go out there full on, you know, kind of big performance and falling flat on their face, rather than the ones that everyone thinks, "Oh, I like him so much because he's not egotistical at all." And you go, "No, he definitely is. He's just doing a really good
job." Knows exactly what he's doing.
Let's, with
all that pressure now on the
We don't like people puffing themselves up.
Now okay. I've got to sort out my poetry.
I'm not going to look at you when I do this. This is a new poem, and it's a Sunday poem, so I thought it would be appropriate to do today. This is about anyone who has had kids but refuses to give up on their rock and roll dream. And this is about the horror of having it, because I've got two little kids, so I know this well. This is called "Glam Dad's Lost His Rag." Those kids will never know the pain they bring to Britain's former foremost lie-in king. Oh, Sunday, bloody Sunday, pig shit head. His veins and ache and squirm, his tongue half dead, and still they roar their push-me, pull-me blows. Falsetto tuneless shrieks of "Let it go." She kicks him in the shin. When will he learn? A hard-faced three-word gesture. It's your turn. Oh, curse this house, this
cul-de-sac, this life. Oh, curse his deviled offspring, curse his wife. Oh, curse the mirror, curse the paunch and sag. Oh, curse his 30s, glam dad's lost his rag. A streak of pitch black temper, havoc reeks, mascara smear across his grisly cheek. He thunders down the landing, knotted back, a slurring threat of discipline and smacks. A raging, unwashed monster, rank with gin, his unshod soul impaled on tank engine, all dressing gown on inside out, he tolls, "Just grow up, will ya?" to his 3-year-old. Last night, won't someone take me there? Thighs bulging in his drain pipes, back combed hair, Shakira hipped the snarling ghost of Strummer. His band of teachers, architects and plumbers fucking nailed it. Big riff, the indie dream. At times he felt like he was 17. And how the lyrics from that cover set come back to him right now. What do I get? Oh, what do I get? What went wrong? This was not the plan. We came third in Battle of the Bands in grades in 99. Don't look so shocked. The Essex County Standard said we rocked. We supported Cast in Colchester. I've met the bloody ginger one from Blur. Island Records gave us demo money. What now? What's so funny? Beneath them on the floor, his kids are grins. A nervous sideways glance, then it begins, the stuttered giggles, then the gasping laughs, he catches his reflection in the glass. A sallow, red-cheeked, stubbled, panda-eyed, sack-stomach, tragi clown with gaping fly, they thump the carpet. "Daddy, you're so silly, your face looks funny, we can see your..." And now he's laughing too, his ego shelved. Time halts, and for that moment, he's himself. He gathers up his brood. It feels sublime. Come on then, you two. It's breakfast time. Don't clap. The applause of one man brings back.
But it's the whole room, mate. It's the whole audience just applauded. Them. So them, yeah. That was brilliant. Thank you very much. Thanks for that. I'm hoping that one of the many bands that got referenced in that poem comes up on your iPod next, because that would be pretty lovely.
You might have some Blur. I don't think there's any Cast on there.
No Smiths?
There might be some Smiths. There's stacks of Smiths. In fact, there's probably as much chance of a Morrissey track, Morrissey or Smiths track coming up than anything else.
Well, let's see. Let's see what Luke's iPod throws up next. Here we go. Luke Wright's iPod. Take two. Echo Belly. Nice one, mate. Oh, let's play a sting. I haven't played a sting in ages.
Fubar. There's a sting. Giving radio the finger.
What a great sting. Great. I mean, the quality of the stings.
Why
on
are
Fubar.
They called stings?
Because they're just quick in and out. They
like
just hit
sting.
You.
I don't know. I thought sting took forever.
Oh. Yeah. Ah. Tantric. A tantric joke
there.
Good.
I mean, Sunday afternoon on the Lord's Day.
It's weird that Sting put that whole thing out there so much, didn't he? The
tantric thing.
Wanted everyone to know how tantric he was. I mean, no. I bet there are other tantric musicians who just keep it on the hush.
But he strikes me as a man with a huge lack of self-awareness.
Yes.
Isn't that the thing?
Like, yeah.
You know, everything, I guess when you've been Sting, like, maybe you don't really care what people think of you. Maybe you're utterly aware and you're just fine. Like, you know,
bring everything up all the time. Well,
like a Morris dancer.
Yeah.
Like a new agey Morris dancer. You just, you know, that's what I love about Morris dancers. They know what they look like. They're aware of it. They just don't care.
Yeah, yeah. They just stopped caring.
It's like me with having Echo Belly on my iPod. I'm, you know, sound confident and fine.
I think everyone enjoyed that, to be fair. Yeah. Sting is obviously, like, the Police hated each other, and Stuart Copeland used to have, "Fuck you, you cunts," or something written on all of his drums, and it was written on his drums in gaffer tape, and then Sting's face was on the final drum, and he would just hit them all really hard.
Wow, I did not know that. I don't know very much about the Police, really.
Sting could see that, obviously. He was on the same stage as him, look over and see exactly what was going on.
The Everly brothers, Phil and Don Everly, they hated each other by the end of it all, or quite soon into the middle of it, and every sort of 10 years or so, I'm not sure if the Everly brothers are dead yet, but every sort of 10 years or so, they had to get together and tour, simply so they could make some money. And they were just tore utterly apart from each other, and then they would come together, and they're just a duo, and they're singing harmonies and duets together, these old songs. And there's something so, you know, there's something so intimate and personal about singing a song with someone. That to do it with someone that you actually hated, I wondered whether at that moment it was all forgotten and they lost themselves in the moment, or whether they still hated each other when they were playing those songs. It's a weird thing, isn't it?
Sometimes I wonder if that makes it better. If actually we've got it wrong, it's not about having that connection and liking each other. It's about if you hate each other, that's a stronger emotion sometimes.
Well, hate is a very strong emotion, isn't it? And so I guess it all gets sort of wound up. It's that sort of it's like couples having sex towards the end of their relationship when they both already hate each other and they're just horny. It's horrible.
So you think they're doing harmonies and thinking about other people, maybe?
Yeah.
That's what they're doing.
Phil Everly, you know, imagining he's singing with the Big Bopper.
Yeah. I was thinking about Art Garfunkel today.
Yeah.
When we were on stage.
Simon and Garfunkel hate each other as well?
They did at the end, yeah, apparently. Well, I think that they've tried to play it down a bit more since, but yeah, they definitely... there was a bit of like
it's natural fallout with people in groups and stuff like that. I mean, you know, if you clash, then you're going to do it on a daily basis. You see it at work all the time. I was in a group of poets called IL 16 when we used to do shows together. We still sort of nominally exist, but we don't really work so closely together. But for a year and a half or so, we were, you know, in my car all the time touring around, and me and one of the other guys, and we're still mates. But the fact we're still mates because we stopped working together, because I think we just weren't. We were good mates, but we weren't a good fit when it came to doing serious work stuff together.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that's what happens when you start working with mates. You're not supposed to be colleagues. You're supposed to just be drinking buddies and that's it.
Especially when one of you really wants to do something and the other one is kind of like not that bothered. That's the worst. When you're suddenly cracking the whip with your friend who just wanted to have a bit of fun.
Yeah, we ended up not doing a run in London because one of the group didn't want to do it. And I was ambivalent. Anyway, and then the other two really wanted to do it, and there was there was a fair bit of resentment at the time because it's someone, you know, denying you work, because they don't want it. Yeah, it's tough, and the more people involved, the more intertwined those things are. And of course, in bands, it's different because you've got the singer who's the main, you know, the focus of attention, the songwriter who everyone sort of loves, and the others always feel like they're a support act. So, yeah,
that was the first band I was ever in, so I would have been 14, I think.
What did you do in the band?
Drums.
You were a drummer? Oh, bet everyone loved you.
Yeah.
Drummers are in short supply.
Oh, mate, I was so popular.
Yeah. But you were like in six bands.
Yeah, well, no, I've been one at a time, but I was in a lot of... Because obviously they're all very short-lived when you're a teenager. But and I was always the one cracking the whip all the time and being like, come on, guys, got a band practice and all this and sorting out the gigs and whatever. And the first gig we ever did was in a youth centre in a boxing ring. And my friend Jake was meant to be playing keyboards and didn't turn up to any of the practices, and then turned up on the day of the gig just with his keyboard. And we're like, okay, fine, you know.
Confidence and aplomb.
But like he just didn't play anything. So we're like, we'll just turn his keyboard down so no one can hear it, and it's fine. So we did that, but he wore a massive afro wig and these huge yellow shades he bought.
That's cool.
So he did that, and he just jumped around like a madman, and everyone loved him in the room. So everyone loved Jake. He was dancing around in the audience.
He was your own Bez.
Yeah, but then for a week afterwards, people were, you know, all the people at school and whatever were coming up to him and going, you're the guy from that band. And me and my friends were not emotionally mature enough to deal with that at 14. So the next gig we did, we were just like, he didn't come to any practices again. So the day before...
He didn't need to, man.
Yeah, he didn't need to. And now I would just let him do it. But as a 14-year-old, I went, you can't do it unless you haven't practiced, mate. You can't do it. So he went into the woods and smashed up his keyboard. It was not a good day.
Oh, wow.
Not a good day. And
poor old Jake. What does Jake do now?
Jake is... he works in a bar in Kettering, which is where I'm from.
Yeah.
And...
See, Jake could have been the next... you know, great. I'm looking for a keyboard player now. He could have been the next Rick Wakeman.
And
he's working in a bar in Kettering. You did that to him.
Could have been Bez Wakeman.
Bez Wakeman, yeah. Rick Wakeman lives quite close to me. He lives right near Diss. And often when I get on the train, he's on the train as well. But he's nearly always in first class. Rick Wakeman, yeah. Of course he is, yeah.
Reading his Bible.
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm having a go at that. Don't care. He's religious.
Is he religious? I didn't know that.
He is. He's a Christian man.
Christian man.
I saw a documentary he did about it.
About his Christianity.
About being about if it's relevant in this day and age, that was what it was. So it was going around and talking to people in the street and showing them Jesus quotes and saying, do you know who said that and stuff like that.
Blimey.
Most of them didn't.
Now, can you imagine if you were just walking down the shopping and Rick Wakeman came up to you and started, like, you know, Bible bashing in front of you?
Yeah. Well, that's what a lot of people were just delighted to see. So a lot of people weren't even hearing, like, what he was saying.
Everyone was like, yes.
Everyone was just, yeah. Everyone was just like, oh, yeah, Wakeman. I think one guy was just like, he said to the guy who said this, and he went, Rick Wakeman, another prog rock legend. And Wakeman's just like head in his hands going, can't believe I've done this. But, you know, fair enough.
From one Messiah to another.
Yeah.
But exactly. He seems like I've seen him on the telly and the radio, like, you know, an affable, larger than life character.
Nice guy.
He's not the only one. Brian Eno's brother lives in Bungie, where I live.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, it's just legends of
all
the 70s.
These places now have, like, lyrical, poetic quality to them. Diss and Bungie.
Yeah, Bungie's where I live, and Diss is where the station is, so I spend quite a lot of time going between the two. But
what's Diss like? I've always seen it on signs.
Do you know what? Diss, when you pull into the station, you think, oh, Diss is horrible. It's this great big, just, it's like an industrial estate. But actually, when you get into the old centre of Diss, it's quite pleasant. It's quite nice.
What a nice place. If I was in Diss for one day?
I would, there's, what would I do if you were in Diss for one day? There's a cracking chippy. See, that's your lunch sort. There's a nice park with a nice duck pond there.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah, and there's now an Aldi. Can I say that? There are other supermarkets.
I said cunt earlier.
Yeah. You can't say Aldi. Draw the line at Aldi. there's now an Aldi as well, which is quite exciting, isn't it? So, you know, you're
people
covered.
Are more. I like how Lidl and Aldi have got a bit more of a... Like, Lidl now, that the bakery section of Lidl...
Yeah,
it's quite highly regarded.
Because it's imported from France. I've been well aware of this because my father-in-law, who's a man who likes a bargain, has long since has long praised Aldi and done all his shopping at Aldi, and now he's upset because all the Aldi wines find their way into the Guardian wine section, and so what he calls middle class wankers get the wine for him, or the price goes up, and he's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
I remember Ginny Yashere, who I believe I heard you doing a show for earlier on, he might be coming on the show soon, doing this fantastic routine about, I don't know how she got onto it, but she managed to get into the idea of people buying their children at a supermarket. and obviously, I don't know how she got there, but it made sense. You know, simply so she could have the line, who would buy their kids at Lidl? And Lidl was a punchline for years, wasn't it?
It
was the Skoda of supermarkets.
Oh, Lidl and Aldi. Absolutely. Still now, I think people would make fun of them. But
it's cracking.
Have some brioche from Lidl.
Get some of the meat from Lidl or Aldi. Excellent. Good meat. Well priced. And booze. Booze very cheap. Of course. Can't go wrong, mate.
And, you know, and if you're in Lidl, I don't know about Aldi, but you can, you know, get yourself a telescope and some flippers while you're at it.
You've got to take advantage of the Thursday offers. Yeah, it's great. We should do an ad for them.
During the course of this, we've gained ourselves a little sponsorship.
Yeah. If you're out there, Mr. Aldi, Mr. Lidl.
I'd imagine so. Also, we say in prop, my auntie says Lidl.
Lidl.
But that's, you know, each their own.
Each their own. Let
she
her
might
do
be
it.
Right.
Let her do it.
She might be right. I'm not even going to make fun of her.
I think popular opinion is against her on that one, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's how language works, isn't it? Popular opinion.
Well, I don't think she talks to many people about it. Also, you wouldn't pick people up on it.
No.
If someone said to you, Lidl, I just always think, I think that there's bigger battles than this.
Yeah, exactly. Pick your battles. As a father of a toddler, you know, you quickly learn that you have to pick your battles. Like,
yeah. Because you're probably mainly about two kids you've got.
I've got two kids, yeah. I've got two
How
kids.
How old are they?
I've got, one's five, or five and a half, almost six, and the other one is just turned three. Two boys, and they're a handful. They're hard work.
Yeah.
Don't do it.
No, well, I'm not planning to at the minute. I love being an uncle for the same reasons everyone does.
Well, because you can give them back.
Yeah. Clock out.
Yeah, exactly, and you know, and yeah, everyone likes an uncle, don't they?
Yeah,
you know exactly, because you know, look, fun Uncle James is coming round.
Yep.
Like he's wearing his tie.
Being a real laugh.
Yeah, exactly, and then you get to sort of wander off, and then they kind of collapse with the sugar rush that you've caused.
And your
sibling has to wrestle them into bed.
Absolutely,
that's the way it goes. Yeah,
it's a lot of fun. I just walk away whenever if they start acting unreasonable.
Exactly, just go, it's broken.
See you later, mate.
Yeah.
See you later.
How old are your nephews and nieces?
I've got two 2-year-olds All nephews. So my brother's got a 2-year-old and my sister has a 2-year-old and a, I guess it'd be 5-month-year-old now.
Are you the baby of the family?
I'm not. I'm the oldest one.
Oh, you are. Yeah. Do they just knuckle down?
Yeah,
and
they knew what they wanted to do.
Yeah.
They got they met the their partners, got married, had their kids, and yeah, that's what they wanted to do.
So they do normal jobs.
Yeah. They've got, my brother works in a cardboard box factory, and my sister is a driving instructor.
Uh-huh.
So
they're
yeah.
normal jobs. Yeah,
they just got on with it.
Pay and everything, not this sort of crazy.
Not this stuff. And I don't
shouting
know.
And
don't know where my
strangers.
Next meal's coming from. But can't provide for kids like that.
That was a choice you made. Fun yeah. Uncle James. Hey, yeah. Look at, hey, where are you sleeping tonight, fun Uncle James?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I see. Well, once I actually did sleep in a bush, and all I had on me clothing wise in my bag was a red dress I bought for someone else, so I ended up wearing the dress in the bush. And my mum has taught my 2-year-old nephew Charlie to ask me every time he sees me if I'm sleeping in a bush tonight. And if I ever got a bag or anything, he asked me, is there a red dress in there?
Oh.
So that's, and she's delighted with that. She just cries laughing every
time he asks
me.
I told my sons that the reason that my wife hasn't got a willy is because it dropped off and they believed it. And now every day they go, your willy dropped off. Yeah, I'm not very popular at the moment. Yeah, it's good. Best joke. It's a good joke. Yeah, it's great. Yeah, I was going to probably, you know, cause them sort of some sort of lasting damage when they found the truth. But, you know.
Yeah, the way actually ever be able to look a lady without thinking she used to have
exactly I'm breeding misogyny in my house clearly great good
but, you know bought your 5 minutes of peace didn't it when
exactly
they were laughing at someone else
exactly
so
right
okay.
exactly right and for that it was worth it.
Okay, so let's play another song from my iPod this time. Let's see what it throws up. Here we go. They killed her too. Mum and Dad by Frank Zappa and the Mothers there.
Fantastic, that was good.
I've only just started, there's a comedian called Mark Maron who does a routine about finally...
W2F
podcast. Yeah. He does a routine about finally deciding to get into Beefheart.
Yeah.
Because it's been hanging over him his whole life. And I've done that recently with Zappa and Beefheart. It's kind of, I've got to... Come, I've been putting this off for too long now.
Yeah, I've done that. It was the last line of that song, and they killed her too.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a good last line of the song. It's good, I didn't hear the rest of the lyrics, but that did it for me.
It is a good line, isn't it? They killed her too, and there you go. That's from a concept album, which don't get a lot
what
of that.
What's the concept?
I think it's I'm piecing it together as I go along, but it's about the Beatles and it's called In It for the Money.
Uh-huh.
And it seems to be kind of like about a Beatles esque band, maybe.
Oh right, yeah.
But it's
I think all albums should be concept. Quite frankly, if you haven't got a concept, don't waste my time with your songs. Like fucking make, you know. I mean, I kind of think, I feel like, but you know, it's got the same about sort of shows, really. Like I've done some shows which aren't really connected. But even then, there's that sort of aesthetic driving it forward, which I guess you also get with a band. You get that good cohesion. But I think there's, I don't know, I just think, you know, why not have a concert? Why not have a point to what you're talking about, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think increasingly you do have to have a story because marketing is so fierce now and bands really have to fight to get noticed. There has to be a story around the album, you know? If you look at that Damon Albarn album that came out last year, you know, there was a bit of stuff about technology on that, but they made that such a thing. He's written this album about technology. There was a couple of tracks about kind of technology. A lot of it was just sort of Damon being sad about things, which is fine. But they really picked those stories out and they really had to sell them and stuff like that. And I think, you know, I think you should kind of think about the cohesive whole of an album. Bring back the concept album, that's what I say.
Well, speaking of which, you've got some poems about that are stories as well. Is that right?
Yeah, like, a lot of my poems are stories. They're called ballads.
Yes.
The traditional story form and ballads used to be the way we used to get our news, right? We used to have newspapers. They had these things called broadside ballads, so they'd be like sort of songs or lyrics to songs that could be sung to popular tunes. If they're in ballad meter, they essentially would fit over most music.
Yeah.
And they'd be about things that happen, whether they're sort of more serious, you know, national news, or more sort of like kind of, you know, quirky little stories. And this was a story of a guy called Edward Dando. He was known as a celebrated gormandizer.
Right.
This is from the early part of the 19th century, where during the reign of George IV, who's Hugh Laurie, right? By the time he's stopped being regent and has become the king, and he was known for his opulence. He was addicted to laudanum. And it was sort of an opulent time for those who could afford it. And of course, you could walk, you know, if you were a gentleman, you could walk into any place and have what you liked and then say, put it on my tab, sort of thing.
Right, yeah, yeah.
But you couldn't do that if you were, as this guy is, the apprentice to a hatter. But you thought, nah, fuck it, I'm going to do it anyway. So this is the story of Edward Dando, the celebrated gormandizer. Hurrah, it's me, it's ballad time, hang some bloody bunting. Now shut your eyes, sit back, we're off to 1820-something. The belching Georgian after-party, age of gout and laudanum, where opulence and dropsy spread to all that could afford them. The spitwash swine, Germanic wines, Beau Brummel's ice-cold quips, the clash of Nash's symmetry with George's wobbly bits, frayed pantaloons and powdered cheeks, and boo sucks to your prigs. The Tories had the power, but it was all about the Whigs. And dandies dashed in hackney cabs from bar to drinking shop, a gin-soaked trail of tabs until their foppish waistcoats popped. And just as in our staged school age, the slack-jawed Chasnay's dream of being auto-tuned and airbrushed into pop's harem, so young men walked those gaslit streets of London's rotten heart with grand ideas to take their lives and spin them into art. And so, our hero, Edward Dando, apprenticed to a hatter. We don't know what his hats were like, but they, dear friends, don't matter. For days spent stitching hats for chaps sent Dando mad with boredom. The line of dandruff decades stretched out miserably before him. A member of the lunar race that history near forgot. He might, had he been born later, lined up with Marx's lot, but short on ideology or union or committee, Dando only had a hunch that life was sorta shitty. While some were blessed with tails and titles, others buffed their boots and pickled, stewed and boiled the scraps of labour's rotten fruits. Oh, who will pave my grave with jewels? Oh, who will sing of me? The hatters, blacksmiths, cooks and fools all piled up like scree. And that, thought Dando, shouldn't, couldn't be the way for him. So he resolved to live his life with shellfish, beer and vim. So off then to the oyster house with sawdust on the floor, a pile of shells around his boots, our hero ordered more. Shuck, gulp, drop. Shuck, gulp, drop. And all washed down with porter, the swagger of a Don Juan with his mitts on someone's daughter. And when he'd swallowed 30 dozen, Dando belched and sighed, performed a dance of pocket pats. What rotten luck, he lied. I'm sorry, Mr. Oysterman, I'll have to see you clear another day. All right, old boy, next time I'm passing here. And had Dando been a gentleman, the trader would have bowed and sent him on his merry way, contented with this vow. But swagger isn't breeding, and no sooner out the door, this whistling cocksure hatter felt the rough arm of the law. They banished our voluptuary to Brixton for a month, where Dando's raging hunger gave the other lags the hump. They shackled him in solitary for stealing beef and bread, where there the old screws pummeled him and boxed his grisly head. And when his month of gruel was up, he found the nearest stall, devoured his dose of protein and then coughed up bugger all. Alas, his choice of oyster man, this one was like a bull, and left our hero in the gutter, sore but very full. So Dando spent his life like this, from oyster house to beating, from shellfish stall to court, then jail, and all for sake of eating exactly what he wanted to, exactly what he when he wanted. For every bristling oyster man or judge that he affronted, he gained 100 new admirers. Dando strikes again. Could nothing sate his appetite for oysters, ale and pain? Some 8 long fishy years passed by. He dined on London's best till everybody recognised his black eyes, jail dress and strange distinctive limp, for Dando's foot was lame, a wage of his depravity, a spoil of his game. And he was forced to ply his trade in estuary towns in Kent, though gutter scraps and rozzers followed everywhere he went. Till 1832 came round, the aged sailor king now on the throne, austerity in place of George's bling. And Dando, like his royal exemplar, saw his fortunes fade. One August night in Cold Bath Fields, on prisoner parade, a man collapsed with cholera. They carted him inside, where legend, that forgiving mistress, claims before he died, they brought a dozen oysters to his licey prison bed. He rubbed his stomach, scoffed the lot, and then he fell back, dead. They buried him in Clerkenwell, beneath St. James's bells. The balladeers sung songs of him, and paved his grave with shells.
Man, I want some oysters now. So badly I want some oysters.
Oh, I love oysters. There used to be a bloke who used to walk around the Pleasance Courtyard up at the Edinburgh Fringe and sell oysters, pound a pop.
Oh, they were delicious. Yeah. I love them.
I love an oyster.
I love them, mate.
Port Elliot's got good oysters.
You made them sound very delicious in that. You probably made me want oysters And I'd even take the beating that he got every time he had it.
Well, I think that's obviously the choice he made as well. Yeah. He reminded me of the Naked Rambler. I'm really interested in that guy. You know, the guy, he's in prison for nudity, gets out, he immediately takes his clothes off and he's arrested within half an hour and sent back to prison. And you kind of, it stirs great emotions in me, that, because I just kind of think, let the guy walk around naked, for goodness sake. Like, it makes a real mockery of the law, but also you kind of think also to the guy, you know, going, yeah, principles all very well, but you're spending your life in prison where he's not allowed to be naked, of course.
So. Stop getting naked, yeah. Also, like that Frank Zappa song, yours ended with "and then he died," which is great.
Yes, end on a death. Well, that is the ending to end all endings, really, isn't it?
They die at the end. Fantastic. What's your favourite way to have oysters, by the way?
I like oysters with a sharp sort of onion sort of relish. What do you call it?
I don't know what it is, but I know exactly what you mean.
Onion vinegar kind of there's a guy at Port Elliot that does the oysters, and it's a bit of a tradition. You go get sort of a dozen oysters after our set, and he's got this lovely sort of, like, it's kind of it's sharp, it's like, it's a good bit of chili, but it's also like cucumber in there as well, so it's nice. But obviously a bit of Tabasco is nice, lemon juice is nice. I like to mix it around.
They're one of those things where people who don't like them say that they're revolting, and I absolutely feel sorry for those people so much.
Oh my God,
I really feel sorry for people who don't like oysters.
Oysters are just fantastic,
brilliant,
and also they're an excuse to have onions and vinegar and things. And basically, I'm an onion and vinegar fiend. I love it.
Go right down.
Love vinegar.
Well, back to your iPod, I think.
Yeah,
I think
we've been lucky so far.
Here we go. Let's see. Well, let's see if your luck continues. Here we go. Manic Street Preachers on FUBAR Radio. You're pretty happy so far, aren't you?
Yeah, it was alright, wasn't it? I like that tune.
Yeah, I've not heard that album. I've never heard of it.
It's their sort of like Noi kind of influence, sort of krautrocky kind of album. It's pretty good. It's pretty good.
Yeah.
They're never not interesting, the Manic Street Preachers, even when you think kind of they've committed some sort of some sophomoric kind of faux pas. Like, at least they're kind of interesting with it, you know. And I think James D. Bradfield strikes me as a really nice chap. I'd like
I saw them on Saturday Kitchen once and did not expect to see him on that.
No,
but he does seem like a normal, nice guy.
Yeah, he does.
And Nicky Wire definitely didn't seemed out of place, let's say. They're not comfortable with being on Saturday Kitchen.
Nicky
Wire
just strikes me as a bit of a second year politics student, really. I've seen him interviewed for a few things. I think his heart's in the right place, but he I don't know, I don't think he ever grew up. Being in bands do weird things to people. I once did it's a TV show, and Alex Jones was on, and it was really exciting for me to meet Alex Jones, because I'm a huge Blur fan, and everyone likes to lay into Alex Jones for being the cheesemonger. and because he lives next door to the cameras, doesn't he? He's been photographed with them, which isn't cool. I'll be the first person to say that. Yeah. But he was really nice. He was lovely.
Yeah.
But he also had this sort of like real sort of childlike thing that you see in really rich people. Obviously, he is rich now, but he's not from a rich background. But I think the thing is, if you're in a band from the age of like 18 and you have everything done for you, and I see it in people who've got successful really young, they're just so used to having people do stuff.
They just
haven't fully formed, and they seem a bit sort of, you know, gauche and childlike, and I see that in Nicky Wire. But maybe he's very nice. I'm going to say that. I'd prefer to meet him. Not that he's listening. He might be listening.
Nicky Wire, massive fan.
Massive fan.
Always at my gigs.
Yeah, yeah. In the front row.
Sadly not. Only musician who does come and see is, what's his name? Alex Capri. The lead singer of Franz Ferdinand.
Oh, yeah, Alex Kapranos. Yeah.
Yeah. He goes to see me every tour.
Does he?
Yeah.
I hear good things about him. He's a mate of a mate, and I hear he's sound as a pound.
Lovely, so man. I've only met him once after one of
these. Excellent taste in comedy is what I hear.
Oh, he loves comedy. He loves comedy, mate. He really, really laughs it up. Lovely man. Lovely, lovely man. But yeah, I guess. But I think it's quite cool that Alex James has the farm and the cheese and stuff like that now.
Yeah, it's
like the drummer in REM leaving. And
he's nice. He's a sweet
John
man. You can tell he's a sweet man. And we were on the show. We were on the book show. Marielle Fostrop, who I thought I was really going to like. But they were just all posh wankers, basically, everyone involved with that show. They really were. It was the week that the whole phone hacking thing broke.
Yeah.
And they were sitting around making excuses for Rebecca Brooks. And they were sort of trying to get Alex James in on this conversation by saying, oh, but you live next door, they're quite nice people. And he just was clearly really embarrassed and did not want to be associated
with
it.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was nice, but they're all total cunts. So yeah, we can.
What do you think you would do if you weren't, so if you got to Alex James's position, retired, would you farm life for you, or
no? Well, he doesn't farm, does he? He owns a farm. He'll do it for him. I don't know. He's obviously got a passion for it. I what would I do? I don't know. It's a really good question. I don't think I could ever stop writing because I feel really sad when I don't write.
Yeah,
really sad. Like I only ever get maudlin when I haven't written anything for a couple of weeks. As long as I keep writing, I'm a very happy-go-lucky person. I'm quite contented.
Yeah.
I like watching telly and eating and drinking and, like, you know, laughing and riffing and bantering. That'll do me, as long, you know, but like I do have to keep my hand in with a bit of writing. So yeah, I couldn't imagine retiring.
Yeah. I always have this fantasy every time I'm having a run of bad gigs, which let's say for the sake of argument happens once a month. I always, like, after maybe the fourth bad one in a row, as in humiliatingly
bad.
That's
the point, isn't it? What's the thing is, you're never more than 5 bad gigs away from quitting.
Is that what it is?
That's what someone said to me once. I thought, oh, that's not true. And I thought, actually, 5 in a row. But then you gig quite a lot. You must gig, like, what, 5 times a week? So?
Every night.
Yeah, every night, really.
Yeah.
Wow.
So sometimes more than once a night. So this week I had, in 1 week, I've had a lady shout "you suck" in my face as I'm leaving the venue. I've had a woman jump on stage and try and steal the mic off me so she can tell everyone about the menopause. I've had a man shout "you're fucked" at me as he's getting chucked out the venue and giving me the finger. I've had someone shout "gay" really loud, and then a group of Scottish people threaten to beat that guy up during my gig. So this is all in 1 week. I've had quite a pretty rough week this week.
You're obviously doing something right.
Yeah, something's going on.
No one's here hated, James.
But what I do when I have a bunch of ones on the trot is I start thinking about moving to Kenya all the time. It's always Kenya, because my dad used to live there when he was 23.
Do you really?
So I always think I want to go to Kenya.
My mum's from Zimbabwe.
Is she?
Yeah, she is. Yeah, she's grabbing Zimbabwe.
Have you visited?
I have a long time ago before the sort of the trouble started there. I have. Yeah, it's not for me. That sort of landscape. Yeah, no, I need sort of undulating hills and sort of greenness and wetness. Really,
yes.
I think I'm English. Yeah. To my car. I felt the same when I was in America and California.
Right.
I was like, it's so big, I could never dominate this place. Terrifies me. I don't even like it out in the fens with all that sky. You know, although we've got big skies as we are in East in Bungay in North Suffolk, but it's not quite as sort of like
down.
Breathless as when you get out
Wear
towards Peterborough sort of way. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'd like to go to Zimbabwe. I think I went to Kenya once for 2 weeks.
Yeah,
when I was like, I think 21, and
they're miles. They're very different places, aren't they? They're very, very miles apart. No one fall into that. Yeah, but Zimbabwe. Yeah, it was. I mean, do you know what? It was. It used to be called the Rice Bowl of Africa. That was its nickname because it is a verdant country.
Yeah,
it's certainly no means sort of like all safari. It's not really safari at all.
Yeah.
But it just. I don't know. I mean, I enjoyed it as a kid. But you know what it's like when you're 12, right, and your mum goes, we're going to Zimbabwe for 6 weeks over the summer holidays. You kind of think, no, I want to go to my friend's house and go swimming in Clacton. But it was definitely an experience, never forget it and all that. But
When you're a kid and your parents say, we're doing something as a family, the amount you don't want to do it.
I do it to my kids now. Yeah. We're going to have a family day out.
Yeah, just don't want to. I said every week my parents on a Saturday would say we're going to go for a walk, going to go for a countryside walk, and
I love a countryside walk.
We would hate being told that because it would always be like as we were watching Live and Kicking or something, they'd break that to us. And then as soon as we started the walk, I'd be loving it, absolutely loving the whole walk. We'd make up stories on the walk for the whole thing.
Nice.
I wouldn't want to go back home. And then next week they go, we're going for a walk. No, I hate walks. You loved it last week. You made up that story about
the dragon. One of the things I've really learned about being a parent is kids do not know what's good for them. The kids don't even know what they enjoy. They really don't, like. And we do know, and it's so hard to try and reason with a 5-year-old
you just don't reason with them. Is that right, or do you just still try?
Oh,
try and teach him.
My friend Stuart today was, he's got a 3-year-old, and he was saying, yeah, no, I've been trying to reason with Wolfie this week. I went, listen to yourself. he's like, yeah. And he just looked at me and he looks so defeated. He's like, I know. And we both try and reason with our toddlers. Yeah. And just because you just go, if they could just understand this thing.
Yeah.
And you go, no, do you know, it took me 33 years to understand that.
Yeah.
I wasn't even at that stage when I had kids. You know, it's having kids that makes you, does make you reasonable, because you are the miserable ferret of compromise.
Right, yeah. Yeah. I guess you think you're going into an argument you can win as well. Every time you think,
really
I'm equipped for this.
Because, like, do you know what? They don't care. They don't care about anything enough for you to take it. I go, well, I'll take that away. They go, yeah. My father was particularly like that. He's not really, you know, he doesn't, you know, he has a little obsessions with things that last very short period of time.
Okay.
And then he's on to the next thing. So it's really hard to kind of discipline him. You know, you can't take anything. He goes, I'll take this thing away. He's all right. I'll just form an attachment to that thing that you wouldn't even imagine that I'd like, because why would anyone like it? Because it's a stone. But, you know, so yeah, he always, you know, he wins. And so he realised quite early on that it's, you know, carrot works a lot better than stick.
Right, yeah.
I just bribe my children to make them vaguely do what I want them to do.
Great.
Oh, well, I bribe them to do things that I know that they'll enjoy, and then not only do they have the thing that they enjoy, they then get the bribe at the end of it as well. They're living the life of Riley, those kids, I tell you.
I'll give you this jelly if you eat that cake.
Yeah, basically, that kind of, yeah, that's
what
it.
What a great deal. Mine was just no pocket money. And then when I was a kid, and I was like, oh,
yeah, they're a bit young for pocket money.
I guess I'm doing it then. I didn't get pocket money for quite a while. But
yeah,
I think I wasn't naughty for a while.
Yeah.
It took me a while to learn to be naughty. Honestly.
Well, unfortunately, I think our 3-year-old might be quite pliant and subservient, but he's learnt from his older brother just that being acting like an unreasonable little twat is the way to go. So
everything falls into your lap.
Everything falls into your lap. Yeah. No.
Well, let's
anyway, on that. Yeah.
A lesson for the listeners: act like a twat, and everything works out for you. It's actually pretty much the way it works.
That is the lesson of life. There isn't anything about the bankers. Think about the Tories.
Yeah.
You know that. You know, you act like a twat, you get your own way.
That's happened. Very few people will stand up to you ever.
No, exactly.
Life.
Be a bully and act immorally, and everyone will give in to you. That's my lesson for life, kids.
Yeah, if you're the one person on a bus kicking up a fuss. I'm unintentionally doing poems, and they're the worst ones ever. So.
Bust and fuss. That was really good.
I didn't mean to do that. I want to point that out. Did not mean to do that. Right, here we go. Let's play another song before I rhyme again by mistake. Here we go. My iPod. Echo and the Bunnymen, Back of Love on FUBAR Radio. Pretty happy with that.
Yeah, that was good, man. That was good.
So we were just talking about, you said you saw them at Latitude as well.
I did see them at Latitude on the glorious summer of 2011, I believe it was. And they did that thing where they knew that everyone was there to hear Killy Moon and a couple of others. And so they save all the good ones till the end. And everyone's there. But that might be a bit unfair. I'm sure there were diehard Echo and the Bunnymen fans, but there were a lot of casual fans because it's a festival. That's what you do. You don't do what Rolls Harris did one year at Glastonbury, and there's lots of things that Rolf Harris does that I wouldn't recommend, but he came on stage and played Tie My Kangaroo Down Sport as the opening track, and we were like, right, done, and we all walked
away.
But it was really weird. He came out, just like these beats came on, and then like a rapper came out and did like this proper like warm up. Everyone goes shouting, everyone say Rolf Harris, and he's like freestyling and rapping about Rolf Harris to this big beat, right? And it's really weird. And then Rolf Harris sort of waddles on, kind of waving at everybody, you know, thinking the dark thoughts that we now know he was thinking.
Yeah.
Of course, back then we thought he was thinking saintly things, but he's. Yeah, I never liked Rolf Harris, and it's easy to say that now, but I never did. It was always boring. I could always tell what it was.
It was always a Rolf Harris. As a kid, I used to watch Rolf's Cartoon Club all the time. Loved it.
I hated it. Absolutely no, not a fan at all. No, hated it.
Did you draw cartoons?
That's probably why. I was probably a bit bitter about those people.
Drew cartoons all the time. I loved it.
Did you? You cartoon person?
Yeah.
I wish I had that talent.
Yeah.
That music. Able to play music. Well, I mean, I can play guitar, but badly. But you know, one of those people like, I love Regina Spektor. I was hoping Regina Spektor's track might come up, but you know, to have that kind of talent that she's got on the piano, that sort of completeness.
I don't know if you watch Orange Is the New Black. Probably
I don't, but I know that she did the theme tune for it.
Did the theme tune for it, which I like it. I think it's cool, but it's not really a good representation of
No way whatsoever. But that feels very much like a commission.
Yeah, yeah.
That song. I mean, she's got a couple of sort of like guitar rocky kind of ones, but no, I mean, that's not what she excels at. She's best when she's going like that into the microphone and, like, and playing this dark kind of, yeah. Apparently her, you know, she's really into Chopin.
Like a big influence
on her, which is great to have someone who's like, you know, into Joni Mitchell and to Chopin to bring those two things together. I think she's awesome, Regina Spektor. She just kind of blows my mind. She's just that good.
It's good to have people like that, I think.
Yeah.
Artists like that who you can properly
get into. I think she gets a bit saccharine and a bit, you know, a bit cutesy pie and all that. And I don't like everything that she does, but the fact that I can accept all that and still be kind of blown away at that.
Yeah.
At the sort of diversity of her songwriting.
It comforts me as well to have artists that I really love who I can identify where there's stuff that I don't like. I just go, well, as a performer myself, it means I don't have to always be perfect and stuff like that.
Exactly.
It's like,
yeah,
it's,
you know,
incredibly,
it's a subjective thing, isn't it? Comedy's a subjective thing, poetry's a subjective thing, and, you know, I know, because I have my favourite poets, and there's poets I edit as well through, I run a little press, and you know, I can edit a book, and I can say quite honestly, like to John Osborne, for example, whose new book I'm editing at the moment, I can say, well, you know, to be honest, this is going in. I can see it's good. It's not for me, you know, but I love this next one, you know, and everyone has their favourites, and that's natural. That's natural, and we shouldn't beat ourselves up as artists about whether, you know, about trying to please. You can't please all the people all the time.
You can't.
Someone once said to me, and that's a truism, but it's a really useful one if you're an artist.
It's quite hard to remember those things as well. The things that you've been told your whole life, but you still kind of like, if ever you've got a deadline to meet.
Maybe because you've been told them your whole life, they start those, you kind of forget the truth of them.
That's why we're always waiting for people like you to put them in a different way for us so that we appreciate them again. That's what it's like, isn't it?
Well, ta-da, to the rescue.
All the pressure's on your shoulders. I was saying to you about, I saw Scroobius Pip once, and a lot of the people were there for the same reason I was there, really, because we'd all bought his solo album and we loved it, and we knew that he was going to do poems, spoken word, from that album.
What solo album is that? It's Distraction Pieces.
It was Distraction Pieces.
That's the sort of first one that he did.
Yeah.
It's
his solo one that he did. And really excited about it.
Yeah.
And everyone around me was singing along for the whole thing and shouting out.
Yeah.
And I got grumpy and was like, well, this isn't what sort of I want to hear him sing. But was I wrong there? Should it be okay that everyone's just shouting with them? So I thought, fair enough if it's a song, but if it's spoken word,
I wasn't at that gig. I programmed that gig, so ta-da. Thank you. It's all
well, I did
me.
Very well. It was bloody packed, mate.
So. It was packed. But I didn't see that gig. I don't know. Yeah, I guess it could be quite annoying. But that's that kind of sort of festival attitude, really. You don't really go to a festival and go, shh, everyone make shh.
Well, exactly. I was like, well, I've got to leave here.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm the one who's...
Yeah.
Not...
Well, yeah. Not, I mean, I can see why it was irritating, though. Yeah.
But still.
I think if someone starts singing along to a poem, shut up. You know,
but then
you know, that was a pretty, you know, it was pretty buzzy that night in that tent.
Well, what was great about that was that I got there really early because I wanted to see him, but I ended up as a result watching quite a few poets that I hadn't heard of before, and in a proper focused environment, I just loved it.
There was probably an excellent run of well programmed and curated poetry.
I was sitting there going, whoever curated and programmed this
did an excellent job. And one day I'd like to thank them in person.
I can't thank you enough. But
well, I'm glad you enjoyed it, and I'm sorry those insolent teenagers spoiled it.
No, it was good to see that. I mean,
I guess it's like when you go to those Python gigs, but everyone was like chanting along with it, which is, it's just not how comedy should be. It's probably not how spoken word should be. But then it's the same way when you go to those sort of arena gigs. That's not how comedy should be either. It's basically worship, isn't it? It's not. Yeah. It stops being an artistic endeavour and basically becomes worship at the church celebrity. I'm always against that sort of thing.
Yes.
It's weird. And that's why I felt when I did that support slot for John Cooper Clarke in London recently at the Royal Festival Hall, because there was like 2,500 people there. And Johnny Clarke's been kind of in a sort of second wind for his career for about sort of 4 or 5 years. So the real fans saw him 4 or 5 years ago. Some of them might come back, but there's a lot of people. It really did feel there was like a few celebs and stuff in the audience. It really kind of felt a bit like, oh, we're going to this thing because it's this cool thing. It wasn't the best venue for it,
yeah,
or the best place for it in a way. Although they weren't sort of audibly chanting along. But people did. People used to sing along to John Cooper Clarke. People used to dance to John Cooper Clarke.
Right,
the
yeah.
Punks used to pogo to his words because he had such a nice beat to them, yeah.
So it's nice it comes to that. Because that's the thing, isn't it? When it happens the first time round,
yeah.
We're doing it for the right reasons. We'll fit. But then if I was to go now and go and think to myself, I should pogo to this because people used to do it back in the it's absolutely not.
Well, that's the thing about this trail of Britpop bands. I guess it happens for every generation. It's happening for our generation now, is that these bands that we loved when we were 14 or 15 have realised that we now have disposable income and they're reforming and trying to get their hands on our disposable income. So they're doing, you know, all the comeback gigs and the bands reforming and that sort of thing. And they're different sort of things, aren't they? Because when you go see a band when you're 14, like, especially, you know, back then in the pre-internet, pre-sort of being able to get whatever song you wanted whenever you wanted kind of time, which, you know, we were kind of almost the last generation to grow up with that. You had to, you know, if you liked a band and they're a bit rare, you had to go to the record shop, you had to order it in, you had to discover it on the enemy, you had to hear it on the evening session or, you know, whatever. And then you go and you'd probably be the only kid from your school there, maybe, because all the other kids were into different kind of music. And you really, and they were hopeful things because... It was depressing being a teenager in some ways because nobody understood you and you got bullied, if you might have got bullied. And then when you went those gigs, you kind of felt that actually, do you know what, in a couple of years' time I'm going to get out of here and I'm going to meet people like the people at this gig and my life's going to be all right.
Yeah.
And now when you go watch those same bands, it's a different thing. Rather than being a forward-looking, hopeful thing, it's a nostalgia trip.
Yeah.
And it's brilliant at first and it can still be brilliant at the end of it, but there is this sort of... Ersatz quality to it where he's sort of looking around and you're thinking we're trying to remember what it felt like in a way.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not to say that it's tragic or sad to be in your 30s because it's not actually. It's much more fun being in your 30s than it is to be a teenager, but there is something about that excitement which I think you never get back.
Oh,
and you have to accept that if you're going to go to one of those reunion gigs, otherwise you might find yourself looking at the singer and considering your own mortality.
The first gig I went to was really like them that much now, but like it was a band called Bush.
Bush
at the
Swallowed.
Yes, I did Swallowed. Yeah. That was their encore. They played the Echo and the Bunnymen trick.
Yeah, yeah.
But I went to them at Cambridge Corn Exchange.
Razor Blade Suitcase, was that the name of the album?
That was that album, yeah. I've still got that album.
What does that mean?
Quite good. I don't think he even knows.
Yeah.
But he's all right, he's going out with Gwen Stefani now.
Still?
But, I think so, yeah.
God, they've been probably together for about 20 years.
Quite a while.
Good on.
That gig was like at the times the only live gig I'd ever been to. It's the most amazing experience of my life. I thought it was incredible. It was reviewed in Metal Hammer, and along the side of the there's a column on the side just interviewing people at the gig, and one guy who was probably in his 30s at least, probably maybe 40s.
Yeah.
His quote was, "It was good. It was better than I thought it would be." And when I read that as someone who had just been to the best night of their life, I thought, what the fuck is your problem, mate? Yeah. Turning up not expecting it to be good. No wonder you... really angry that you didn't even expect it to be good.
And I felt the same way. I saw Suede at Braintree Arena in 1996. It was just mind-blown exciting. And I deliberately, even though I love Suede, did not go and watch them at Latitude a couple of years ago because I didn't want anything to get in the way of that gig. But I've become that guy because a mate of mine said, I've got a spare ticket to the Horrors. And I don't like the Horrors, right? Because they're a bit dirgy, and I like stuff that's clean and sparse and spiky. Yeah. And, you know, I can appreciate why people like them. And I went, all right, I'll give them a go. So I got their latest album, and I listened to it loads to try and get into it. And I went to go watch the gig, and I just thought they didn't like them. I thought, you know, it's not my sort of thing. I thought they were a bit louche and a bit too like up themselves, and they didn't really put on a performance. It's not what. I haven't worked in theatre and stand up, you know. I like my performance to sweat for me to really sort of, or to be able to pull off the coolness, you know, in the way that like Reg D. Hunter can pull off being cool. I'll take it from him because he doesn't drop one bead of sweat.
Yeah.
And you either got to do that perfectly.
Yeah.
Or you've got to throw yourself into it. And they were a bit in the middle. So I didn't like it. But yeah, I was that guy who came along and was like, you know, I didn't want to be there. I thought it was all right.
Yeah.
Not for me. But there was kids at the front. In fact, a friend of the guy we went with, his daughter had been there. And, you know, it'd be like the best night of her life.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? And I realised at that moment that it was my problem.
I'm that guy now.
Yeah.
Right, let's have another song for your iPod and see what it throws up. Oh, I've just pressed skip forward, so I've now seen what the track is. And we've been speaking about him enough, so here he is. It's Morrissey. Morrissey on, well, I don't know what I've done there. I think I've done something wrong to the I don't know what I did, mate. I don't know what I did. Anyway, got to end the show anyway, so fair enough. My thanks to my guest Luke Wright. You can if you want to find out more about Luke, it's lukewright.co.uk on it's called the internet. So thank you very much, Luke.
Thank you.
And see you later, everyone. Bye. One more song. Where?